back to work, he said, and Zoe needed time to adjust to the school schedule, and Annika needed to get back, too. A student at the Holy Names Academy, she needed to return so that she could consult with fellow students and prepare some kind of project they were working on that concerned sustainable living. She spoke of it with urgency, but only after she understood that Denny was planning on heading west before any of the other cousins. Only after she realized that if her needs and Denny's needs coincided, she might win for herself 5 hours next to him in his car. 5 hours of watching his hands hold the steering wheel. 5 hours of seeing his tousled hat head, of inhaling his intoxicating pheromones. The morning of our departure came, and the storm had settled in, and the windows of the cabin were pelted with a freezing rain, the likes of which I had never experienced. Denny fretted for most of the morning. The radios announced the closure of Stevens Pass because of the storm. Traction devices were required on Snoqualmie Pass. "Stay! Stay!" That's what they said, the insipid cousins. I hated them all. They smelled rank. Even when they showered, they put on the same sweaters without washing them, and their sour odor returned to them like a boomerang. We ate lunch quickly, and then we left, stopping at a gas station along the way to purchase chains for our tires. The drive south was horrific. The freezing rain accumulated on the windshield faster than the wipers could push it away, and every few tedious miles, Denny would stop the car and get out to scrape away the icy glaze. It was dangerous driving, and I didn't like it at all. I rode in the back with Zoe. Annika rode in the front. I could see Denny's hands were gripping the steering wheel far too tightly. In a race car, the hands must be relaxed, and Denny's always are when I see the in-car videos from his races. He often flexes his fingers to remind himself to relax his grip. But for that excruciating drive down the Columbia River, Denny held the wheel in a death grip. I felt very badly for Zoe, who was clearly frightened. The rear of the car moved more suddenly than the front, and so she and I experienced more of the slipping and sliding sensation generated by the ice. Thinking of how scared Zoe must have been, I worked myself into a state of agitation, and I let myself get carried away. Before I knew it, I was in a full-blown panic. I pushed at the windows. I tried to clamber to the front seat, which was totally counterproductive. Denny finally barked, "Zoe, please settle Enzo down." She grabbed me around the neck and held me tightly. I fell against her as she lay back, and she started singing a song in my ear, one I remembered from her past. "Hello, little Enzo, so glad to see you." She had just started preschool when she learned that song. She and Eve used to sing it together. I relaxed and let her cradle me. "Hello, little Enzo, so glad to see you, too." I would like to tell you that I am such a master of my destiny that I contrived the entire situation, that I made myself crazy so Zoe could calm me on this trip, and thus would be distracted from her own agitation. Truth be told, however, I have to admit, I was glad she was holding me. I was very afraid, and I was grateful for her care. The line of cars trudged steadily but slowly. Many cars were stopped on the side of the road to wait out the storm. The weathermen and women on the radio said waiting would be worse, however, as the front was stalled, the ceiling was low, and when the warm air arrived, as anticipated, the ice would turn to rain and the flooding would begin. When we reached the turnoff for Highway 2, there was an announcement on the radio that Blewett Pass was closed because of a jackknifed tractor-trailer rig. We would have to make a long detour to reach I-90 near George, Washington. Denny anticipated faster travel on I-90 because of its size, but it was worse, not better. The rains had begun, and the median was more like a spillway than a grassy divide between east and west. Still, we continued our journey because there was little else we could do. After 7 hours of grueling travel, and still 2 hours away from Seattle in good driving weather, Denny had Annika call her parents on her cell phone and ask them to find a place for us to stay somewhere near Cleellum. But they called back soon and told us that all the motels were full because of the storm. We stopped at a McDonald's, and Denny purchased food for us to eat. I got chicken nuggets. Then we pressed onward to Easton. Outside Easton, where snow was piled on the sides of the highway, Denny stopped his car alongside dozens of other cars and trucks in the chain-up area and ventured into the freezing rain. He lay down on the pavement and installed the tire chains, which took half an hour. And when he climbed back into the car, he was soaking wet and shivering.
"You poor thing,"
Annika said, and she rubbed his shoulders to warm him. "They're going to close the pass soon," Denny said. "That trucker heard it on the radio."
"Can't we wait here?"
Annika asked. "They expect flooding. If we don't make it over the pass tonight, we might be stuck for days." It was nasty and horrible, snowy and icy, freezing rain. But we pushed on, our little old BMW chugging up the mountain until we reached the summit, where they have the ski lifts. And then everything changed. There was no snow, no ice, just rain. We rejoiced in the rain. Shortly, Denny stopped the car to remove the chains, which took another half hour and got him soaking again, and then we were going downhill. The windshield wipers flipped back and forth as quickly as they could, but they didn't help much. The visibility was terrible. Denny held the wheel tightly and squinted into the darkness, and we eventually reached North Bend, and then Issaquah, and then the floating bridge across Lake Washington. It was near midnight, the five-hour drive having taken more than 10, when Annika called her parents and told them we had made it safely to Seattle. They were relieved. They told her, and she related to us, that the news had reported flash flooding conditions that caused a rock slide closing westbound I-90 near the summit.
"We must have just missed it," Denny said. "Thank God."
"Beware the whimsy of fate," I said to myself. "She is a mean bitch of a lab."
"No, no," Annika said into her phone. "I'll stay with Denny. He's too exhausted to keep driving, and Zoe is sleeping in the back seat. She should be put to bed. Denny said he's happy to drive me home in the morning."
This made Denny turn and look at her questioningly, wondering if he had actually said anything like that. Of course, I knew he hadn't. Annika smiled at him and winked. She ended her call and slipped her phone into her bag.
"We're almost there,"
she said, looking ahead out the windshield, her breaths shallow with anticipation. Why he didn't take action at that moment, why he didn't get right back on the freeway and drive up to Edmonds where her family lived, why he said nothing, I'll never know. Perhaps, on some level, he needed to connect with someone who reminded him of the passion he and Eve used to share. Perhaps. Back at the house, Denny carried Zoe to her room and put her to sleep. He turned on the television, and we watched the footage of Snoqualmie Pass being shut down by the authorities, only for a few days, they predicted, hopefully, though possibly for a week or more. Denny went into the bathroom and shed his wet clothes. He returned wearing sweatpants and an old T-shirt. He pulled a beer from the refrigerator and opened it.
"Can I take a shower?"
Annika asked. Denny seemed startled. With all of the heroics he had been up to, he had almost forgotten about her. He showed her where the towels were, how to work the handheld shower temperature thing, and then he closed the door. He got the extra sheets and pillows and blankets, unfolded the couch in the living room, and made the temporary bed for Annika. When he was done, he went into his bedroom and sat on the end of his own bed.
"I'm fried," he said to me, and then he fell backward so he was lying on the bed, his hands on his chest, his feet still on the floor, his knees dangling over the edge of the bed,
and the rest of him asleep, even though the lights in the room were still on. I lay on the floor near him and fell asleep as well. I opened my eyes and saw her standing over him. Her hair was wet, and she wore Denny's bathrobe. She said nothing. She watched him sleep for several minutes, and I watched her. It was spooky behavior. Creepy. I didn't like it. She opened her robe, exposing a sliver of pale white flesh and a tattoo of a sunburst encircling her belly button. She didn't speak. She shrugged off her robe and stood naked, her large breasts with their brown nipples pointing at him. Still, he was unconscious, asleep. She reached down and slipped her small hands into the band of his sweatpants. She pulled his pants down to his knees.
"Don't,"
he muttered, his eyes still closed. He had driven for more than 10 hours across a harrowing course of snow and ice and flooding. He had nothing left with which to fend off an attack. She pulled his pants down to his ankles, then lifted one foot and then the other to remove them completely. She looked at me.
"Shoo,"
she said.
I didn't shoo. I was too angry. And yet, I didn't attack, either. Something was holding me back. The zebra keeps dancing. She gave me a dismissive look and turned her attention toward Denny. Don't, he said sleepily. Shh, she soothed. It's all good. I have faith. I will always have faith in Denny. So I have to believe what she did to him was without his consent, without his knowledge. He had nothing to do with it. He was a prisoner of his body, which had no more energy, and she took advantage of him. Still, I could no longer stand by and watch. I had been in a position to prevent the demon from destroying Zoe's toys, and I had failed. I could not fail this new test. I barked sharply, aggressively. I growled. I snapped. And Denny suddenly awakened. His eyes popped open, and he saw the naked girl, and he leapt away from her. What the hell? He shouted. I continued to bark. The demon was still in the room. Enzo! He snapped. That's enough! I stopped barking, but I kept my eye on her in case she were to assault him once again. Where are my pants? Denny asked frantically, standing on the bed. What were you doing? I love you so much, she said. I'm married! It's not like it's having sex, she said. And she crawled onto the bed, reaching for him, so I barked again. Make the dog go away, she said. Annika, stop! Denny grabbed her wrists. She squirmed playfully. Stop! He shouted, jumping off the bed, grabbing his sweatpants from the floor and pulling them on quickly. I thought you liked me, Annika said, her mood abruptly darkening. Annika, I thought you wanted me. Annika, put this on, he said, holding out her robe. I can't talk to a 15-year-old nude woman. It's not legal. You shouldn't be here. I'll take you home. She clutched the robe to herself. But, Denny... Annika, please put on the robe. Denny tightened the string on his sweatpants. Annika, this isn't happening right now. This isn't something that happens. I don't know why you thought... You! She wailed, and she started crying. You flirted with me all week. You teased me. You kissed me. I kissed you on the cheek, Denny said. It's normal for relatives to kiss on the cheek. It's called affection, not love. But I love you, she howled. And then she was in an all-out crying fit, her eyes squeezed shut, her mouth contorted. I love you, she kept saying over and over again. I love you. Denny was trapped. He wanted to console her, but whenever he moved near her, she dropped her hands, which were clutching the crumpled robe to her chest, and suddenly her massive breasts, heaving with grief, were exposed to him, and he had to retreat. This happened several times, like a funny toy, a monkey with symbols or something. He approached to comfort her, she dropped her hands, her breasts shot out at him, and he flew back. It's possible I was witnessing a living interpretation of an antique pornographic penny bank, similar to one I saw in a movie called The Stuntman, which depicted a bear copulating with a girl on a swing. Finally, Denny had to put a stop to it. I'm going to leave the room, he said. You will put on the robe and make yourself decent. When you're ready, come into the living room and we can discuss it further. And he turned around and marched away. I followed. And then we waited. And we waited. And we waited. Finally, she came out wearing the robe, her eyes swollen with tears. She didn't say a word, but she went straight to the bathroom. A few moments later, she emerged wearing her clothes. I'll take you home, Danny said. I called my father, Annika said, from the bedroom. Denny froze. I suddenly sensed apprehension in the room. What did you tell him? He asked. She looked at him for a long time before she answered. If her intention was to make him anxious, it worked. I told him to come pick me up, she said. The bed is too uncomfortable here. Good, Denny sighed. Good thinking. She didn't respond, but continued to stare at him. If I gave you the wrong impression, I'm sorry, Denny said, looking away. You're a very attractive woman, but I'm married, and you're so young. This isn't a viable... He trailed off, words not spoken. Affair, she said firmly. Situation, he whispered. She picked up her handbag and her duffel and walked to the foyer. We could all see the headlights when they appeared in front of the house. Annika threw open the door and jogged down the walk to the street. Denny and I watched from the doorway as she tossed her bags in the back of the Mercedes, climbed into the front seat. Her father, in his pajamas, waved and then drove away. 26. That year we had a cold spell in each winter month, and when the first warm day of spring finally arrived in April, the trees and flowers and grasses burst to life with such intensity that the television news had to proclaim an allergy emergency. The drugstores literally ran out of antihistamines. The pharmaceutical companies, those who profit from the misery of others, could have asked for no greater income-generating scenario than a cold, wet winter full of flu shots and NyQuil, followed by a hot spring and record-breaking pollen counts. I believe that people were not so allergic to their environment until they began polluting themselves and their world with so many drugs and toxins. But then, nobody asked me. So while the rest of the world was focused on the inconvenience of hay fever, the people in my world had other things to do. Eve continued with the inexorable process of dying. Zoe spent too much time with her grandparents. And Denny and I worked at slowing the beating of our hearts so we wouldn't feel so much pain. Still, Denny allowed for an occasional diversion, and that April, one presented itself. He had gotten a job offer from one of the racing schools he worked for. They had been hired to provide race car drivers for a television commercial, and they asked Denny to be one of the drivers. The race course was in California, a place called Thunder Hill Raceway Park. I knew it was happening in April because Denny talked about it quite a bit. He was very excited. But I had no idea that he planned to drive himself there, a 10-hour trip. And I had even less of an idea that he planned on taking me with him. Oh, the joy! Denny and me and our BMW driving all day and into the evening, like a couple of banditos running from the law, like partners in crime. It had to be a crime to lead such a life as we led. A life in which one could escape one's troubles by racing cars. The drive down wasn't very special. The middle of Oregon is not noted for its scenic beauty, though other parts of Oregon are. And the mountain passes in Northern California were still somewhat snowy, which made me cringe with the memory of Annika and how she had taken advantage of Denny. Luckily, the snow of the Siskiyous was confined to the shoulders of the highway, and the road surface was bare and wet. And then we fell out of the sky and into the verdant fields north of Sacramento. Stunning. Absolutely stunning. The vastness of a world so intense with growth and birth, and the season of life between the dormant winter and the baking heat of summer. Vast rolling hills covered with newly sprung grass and great swaths of wildflowers. Men working the land in their tractors, churning the soil, releasing a heady brew of smells, moisture and decay, fertilizer and diesel fumes. In Seattle, we live among the trees and the waterways, and we feel we are rocked gently in the cradle of life. Our winters are not cold, and our summers are not hot, and we congratulate ourselves for choosing such a spectacular place to rest our heads and raise our chickens. But around the Thunder Hill Raceway Park, spring is spring. There is no better evidence of the season. And the track? Relatively new, well cared for, challenging, with twists and elevation changes, and so much to look at. The morning after we arrived, Denny took me jogging. We jogged the entire track. He was doing it to familiarize himself with the surface. You can't really see a track from inside a race car traveling at 150 miles per hour or more, he said. You have to get out and feel it. Denny explained to me what he was looking for. Bumps in the pavement that might upset one's suspension, visible seams that he might use as braking zone markers or turn-in points. He touched the pavement at the apex of the turns and felt the condition of the asphalt. Were the small stones worn smooth? Could he find better grip slightly off the established racing line? And there were tricks to the camber of certain turns, places where the track appeared level from inside a car, but were actually graded ever so slightly, usually by design to allow rainwater to run off the track and not puddle dangerously. After we had traveled the entire track and studied all 3 miles and 15 turns, we returned to the paddock. 2 large semi-trucks had arrived. Several men in racing crew uniforms erected tents and canopies and laid out an elaborate food service, while other men unloaded 6 beautifully identical Aston Martin DB5 automobiles, the kind made famous by James Bond. Denny introduced himself to a man who carried a clipboard and walked with the gait of someone in charge. His name was Ken.
"Thanks for your dedication," Ken said, "but you're early."
"I wanted to walk the track," Denny explained.
"Feel free."
"I already did, thanks." Ken nodded and looked at his watch.
"It's too early for race engines," he said, "but you can take your street exhaust out if you want. Just keep it sane."
"Thanks," Denny said, and he looked at me and winked. We went over to a crew truck, and Denny caught the arm of a crew member. "I'm Denny," he said, "one of the drivers." The man shook his hand and introduced himself as Pat. "You got time," he said. "Coffee's over there." "I'm going to take my Beamer out for a few easy laps. Ken said it was okay. I was wondering if you had a tie-down I could borrow."
"What do you need a tie-down for?"
Pat asked. Denny glanced at me quickly, and Pat laughed.
"Hey, Jim," he called to another man. "This guy wants to borrow a tie-down so he can take his dog for a joyride."
They both laughed, and I was a little confused.
"I have something better,"
the gym guy said. He went around to the cab of the truck and returned a minute later with a bed sheet.
"Here," he said. "I can always wash it at the hotel if he shits himself."
Denny told me to get in the front seat of his car and sit, which I did. They wrapped the sheet over me, pressing me to the seat, leaving only my head sticking out. They somehow secured the sheet tightly from behind.
"Too tight?"
Denny asked. I was too excited to reply. He was going to take me out in his car.
"Take it easy on him until you see if he has stomach for it," Pat said. "Nothing worse than cleaning dog puke out of your vents."
"You done this before?"
"Oh, yeah," he said. "My dog used to love it."
Denny walked around to the driver's side. He took his helmet out of the back seat and squeezed it onto his head. He got in the car and put on his seatbelt. "One bark means slower, 2 means faster. Got it?" I barked twice, and that surprised him and Pat and Jim, who were both leaning in the passenger window.
"He wants to go faster already," Jim said. "Got yourself a good dog there."
The paddock at Thunderhill Raceway Park is tucked between 2 long parallel straights. The rest of the course fans out from the paddock area like butterfly wings. We cruised very slowly through the hot pit area and to the track entrance.
"We're going to take it easy," Denny said,
and off we went. Being on a track was a new experience for me. No buildings, no signs, no sense of proportion. It was like running through a field, gliding over a plain. Denny shifted smoothly, but I noticed he drove more aggressively than he did on the street. He revved the car much higher, and his braking was much harder. "I'm finding my visuals," he explained to me. "Turn-in points, braking. Some guys drive more by feel. They get in a rhythm and trust it. But I'm very visual. It makes me feel comfortable to have references. I already have dozens of reference points on this track, even though I've never driven it. 7 or 8 specific things I've noted on each turn from our track walk." Around the turns we went. He noted his apexes and exits for my benefit. Down the straights we picked up speed. We weren't going very fast, maybe 60, but I really felt the speed around the turns when the tires made a hollow, ghostly sound, almost like an owl. I felt special, being with Denny on the racetrack. He had never taken me on a track before. I felt sure and relaxed. Being held firmly to the seat was comforting. The windows were open, and the wind was fresh and cold. I could have driven like that all day. After 3 laps, he looked over at me.
"Brakes are warm," he said. "Tires are warm."
I didn't understand what he was getting at.
"You want to try a hot lap?"
"A hot lap?" I barked twice. Then I barked twice again. Denny laughed.
"Sing out if you don't like it," he said. "One long howl."
He firmly pressed the accelerator to the floor. There is nothing like it. The sensation of speed, nothing in the world can compare. It was the sudden acceleration, not Jim's bedsheet, that kept me pinned to the seat as we gathered speed and flew down the first straight.
"Hold on now," Denny said. "We're taking this at speed."
Fast we went, hurtling faster. I watched the turn approach, scream at us until we were practically past it, and then he was off the accelerator and hard on the brakes. The nose of the car dove, and I was thankful for the sheet, because without it I would have been thrown against the windshield. Slow, 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 the brake pads held the rotors as tightly as they could, burning from the friction. the heat being thrown off the calipers, the energy dissipating. And then he cranked the wheel left, and so smoothly, but without pause, he was back on the gas, and we were pushing through the turn, the G-forces shoving us toward the outside of the car, but the tires holding us in place. They were not hooting, those tires, no. The owl was dead. The tires were screeching. They were shouting, howling, crying in pain. Ah! He relaxed on the wheel at the apex, and the car drifted toward the exit, and he was full on the gas, and we flew out of that turn and toward the next and the next after that. 15 turns at Thunderhill. 15. And I love them all equally. I adore them all. Each one is different, each with its own particular sensation, but each so magnificent. Around the track we went, faster and faster, lap after lap. "You okay?" he asked, looking over at me as we sped nearly 120 miles per hour down the back straight. I barked twice. "I'm going to use up my tires if you keep me out here," he said. "One more lap." Yes, one more lap, one more lap. Forever, one more lap. I live my life for one more lap. I give my life for one more lap. Please, God, please give me one more lap. And that lap was spectacular. I lifted my eyes as Denny instructed. "Big eyes, far eyes," he said to me. Those reference points, the visuals he had identified when we walked the track, moved by so quickly it took me some time to realize that he was not even seeing them. He was living them. He had programmed the map of the racecourse into his brain, and it was there like a GPS navigational system. When we slowed for a turn, his head was up and looking at the next turn, not at the apex of the turn we were driving. The turn we were in was simply a state of existence for Denny. It was where we were, and he was happy to be there, and I could feel the joy emanating from him, the love of life. But his attention and his intention was far ahead, to the next turn and the one beyond that. With every breath, he adjusted, he reassessed, he corrected, but he did it all subconsciously. I saw then how in a race he could plot now to pass another driver 3 or 4 laps later. His thinking, his strategies, his mind, all of Denny unfolded for me that day. After a cool-down lap, we pulled into the paddock and the entire crew was waiting. They surrounded the car, and their hands released me from my harness, and I leapt to the tarmac. "Did you like it?" one of them asked me, and I barked. "Yes!" I barked and jumped high in the air. "You were hauling ass out there," Pat said to Denny. "We've got a real racer on the set." "Well, Enzo barked twice," Denny explained with a laugh. "Two barks means faster." They laughed, and I barked twice again. Faster! The feeling, the sensation, the movement, the speed, the car, the tires, the sound, the wind, the track surface, the apex, the exit, the shift point, the braking zone, the ride. It's all about the ride. There was nothing more to tell about that trip because nothing could possibly be more incredible than those few hot laps that Denny gave to me. Until that moment, I thought that I loved racing. I intellectualized that I would enjoy being in a race car. Until that moment, I didn't know. How could anyone know until he sits in a car at race speed and takes turns at the limits of adhesion, brakes a hair from lockup, the engine begging for the red line? I floated through the rest of our trip. I dreamed of going out again at speed, but I suspected, as it turned out correctly so, that more track time for me was unlikely. Still, I had my memory. My experience I could relive in my mind again and again. Two barks means faster. Sometimes, to this day, in my sleep, I bark twice because I am dreaming of Denny driving me around Thunderhill, the two of us laying down a hot lap, and I bark twice to say faster. One more lap, Denny. Faster! 27. 6 months came, and 6 months left, and Eve was still alive. Then 7 months, then 8. On the 1st of May, Denny and I were invited to the twins for dinner, which was unusual because it was a Monday night, and I never went with Denny on a weeknight visit. We stood awkwardly in the living room with the empty hospital bed while Trish and Maxwell prepared dinner. Eve was absent. I wandered down the hallway to investigate, and I found Zoe playing quietly by herself in her room. Her room in Maxwell and Trish's house was much larger than her room at home, and it was filled with all the things a little girl could want. Dolls and toys and frilly bed skirts and clouds painted on the ceiling. She was immersed in her dollhouse and didn't notice me enter. I spotted a sock ball on the floor, which must have fallen when the clean clothes were being loaded into her dresser, and I pounced on it. I playfully dropped it at Zoe's feet, nudged it with my nose, and then dropped down to my elbows, leaving my haunches tall and my tail upright. Universal sign language for let's play. But she ignored me. So I tried again. I snatched up the socks, flung them in the air, batted them with my snout, retrieved them for myself, and dropped them again at Zoe's feet, and downwardly I faced. I was all prepared for a fun game of Enno Fetch. She wasn't. She pushed the socks aside with her foot. I barked expectantly. One last attempt. She turned and looked at me seriously. "That's a baby game," she said. "I have to be a grown-up now." My little Zoe. A grown-up at her tender age. A sad thought. Disappointed, I walked slowly to the door and looked back at her over my shoulder. "Sometimes bad things happen," she said to herself. "Sometimes things change, and we have to change too." She was speaking someone else's words, and I'm not sure she believed them or even understood them. Perhaps she was committing them to memory because she hoped they would hold the key to her uncertain future. I returned to the living room and waited with Denny until, finally, Eve emerged from the hallway where the bedroom and bathrooms were. The nurse, who spent her breaks obsessively knitting with metal needles that drove me mad with their scraping and scratching, was helping Eve walk. And Eve was brilliant. She was wearing a gorgeous dress, long and navy blue and cut just so. She wore the lovely string of small freshwater pearls from Japan that Denny had given her for their 5th anniversary. And her makeup and her hair, which had grown enough so she could arrange it into some kind of a hairdo, was done that way, and she was beaming. Even though she needed help for her runway walk, she was walking the runway, and Denny gave her a standing ovation. "Today is the first day I am not dead," Eve said to us, "and we're having a party." To live every day as if it had been stolen from death, that is how I would like to live. To feel the joy of life, as Eve felt the joy of life. To separate oneself from the burden, the angst, the anguish that we all encounter every day. To say, "I am alive. I am wonderful. I am. I am." That is something to aspire to. When I am a person, that is how I will live my life. The party was festive. Everyone was happy, and those who were not happy pretended that they were with such conviction that we were all convinced. Even Zoe came alive with her usual humor, apparently forgetting for a time her need to be a grown-up. When the hour came for us to leave, Denny kissed Eve deeply. "I love you so much," he said. "I wish you could come home." "I want to come home," she replied. "I will come home." She was tired, so she sat on the sofa and called me to her. I let her rub my ears. Denny was helping Zoe get ready for her bedtime, while the twins, for once, were keeping a respectful distance. "I know Denny's disappointed," she said to me. "They're all disappointed. Everyone wants me to be the next Lance Armstrong. And if I could just grab it and hold it in front of me, maybe I could be. But I can't hold it, Enzo. It's bigger than me. It's everywhere." In the other room, we could hear Zoe playing in the bath, Denny laughing with her, as if they had no worries in the world. "I shouldn't have allowed it to be this way," she said regretfully. "I should have insisted on going home so we could all be together. That's my fault. I could have been stronger. But Denny would say we can't worry about what's already happened, so please take care of Denny and Zoe for me, Enzo. They're so wonderful when they're together." She shook her head to rid herself of her sad thoughts and looked down at me.
Do you see?
She asked.
I'm not afraid of it anymore. I wanted you with me before because I wanted you to protect me, but I'm not afraid of it anymore. Because it's not the end.
She laughed the Eve laugh that I remembered.
But you knew that, she said. You know everything.
Not everything. But I knew she had been right about her situation. While doctors are able to help many people, for her, they could only tell her what couldn't be done. And I knew that once they identified her disease for her, once everyone around her accepted her diagnosis and reinforced it and repeated it back to her time and again, there was no way she could stop it. The visible becomes inevitable. Your car goes where your eyes go. We took our leave, Denny and I. I didn't sleep in the car on the ride home as I usually did. I watched the bright lights of Bellevue and Medina flicker by, so beautiful. Crossing the lake on the floating bridge and seeing the glow of Madison Park and Leschi, the buildings of downtown peeking out from behind the Mount Baker Ridge, the city sharp and crisp, all the dirt and age hidden by the night. If I ever find myself before a firing squad, I will face my executors without a blindfold. And I will think of Eve, of what she said. It is not the end. She died that night. Her last breath took her soul. I saw it in my dream. I saw her soul leave her body as she exhaled. And then she had no more needs, no more reason. She was released from her body, and being released, she continued her journey elsewhere, high in the firmament where soul material gathers and plays out all the dreams and joys of which we temporal beings can barely conceive, all the things that are beyond our comprehension, but even so, are not beyond our attainment if we choose to attain them and believe that we truly can.
28. In the morning, Denny didn't know about Eve, and I, having awakened in a fog from my dream, barely suspected. He drove me over to Luther Burbank Park on the eastern shore of Mercer Island. Since it was a warm spring day, it was a good choice of dog parks, as it afforded lake access so Denny could throw the ball and I could swim after it. The park was empty of other dogs. We were by ourselves. "We'll move her back home," Denny said to me as he threw the ball. "And Zoe. We should all be together. I miss them." I swam out into the cold lake and retrieved the ball. "This week," he said. "This week I'll bring both of them home." And he threw the ball again. I waded over the rocky bottom until my body gained buoyancy, and then I paddled out to the ball, bobbed forward in the lake, and returned. When I dropped the ball at Denny's feet and looked up, I saw that he was on his cell phone. After a moment, he nodded and hung up.
"She's gone,"
he said, and then he sobbed loudly and turned away, crying into the crook of his arm so I couldn't see. I am not a dog who runs away from things. I had never run away from Denny before that moment, and I have never run away since. But in that moment, I had to run. There was something about it. I don't know. The setting of the dog park, perched on the eastern bank of Mercer Island like that, so ready. The split rail fence, not a containment fence in any way. The entire scene begs for a dog to run, to flee from his captivity, to lash out against the establishment. And so I ran. Off to the south, I burst off down the short path through the gap and the split rail and out onto the big field. Then I broke west. Over the asphalt path and down the other side to the amphitheater, I found what I was looking for. Untamed wilderness. I needed to go wilding. I was upset, sad, angry. Something. I needed to do something. I needed to feel myself, understand myself in this horrible world we are all trapped in, where bugs and tumors and viruses worm their way into our brains and lay their putrid eggs that hatch and eat us alive from the inside out. I needed to do my part to crush it, stamp out what was attacking me, my way of life. So I ran. The twigs and vines whipped my face. The rough earth hurt my feet, but I ran until I saw what I needed to see. A squirrel, fat and complacent, eating from a bag of Fritos, stupidly shoving chips into its mouth,
and I found in the darkest part of my soul a hatred I had never felt before. I didn't know where it came from, but it was there, and I charged that squirrel. It looked up too late. It noticed me long after it should have, if it had wanted to live. And I was on it. I was on that squirrel, and it had no chance. I was ruthless. My jaws slapped down on it, cracking its back. My teeth ripped into its fur, and I shook it to death after that, for good measure. I shook it until I heard its neck snap in two. And then I ate it. I ripped it open with my fangs, my incisors, tore into it, and blood was on me, all the blood, hot and rich. I drank its life, and I ate its entrails, and pulverized its bones, and swallowed. I crushed its skull, and ate its head. I devoured the squirrel. I had to do it. I missed Eve so much I couldn't be a human anymore and feel the pain that humans feel. I had to be an animal again. I devoured, I gorged, I gulped. I did all the things I shouldn't have done. My trying to live to human standards had done nothing for Eve. I ate the squirrel for Eve. I slept in the bushes. Sometime later I emerged, myself again. Denny found me and he said nothing. He led me to the car. I got in the back seat and fell asleep again immediately, with the taste of blood from the squirrel I had murdered fresh in my mouth. I slept. And while I slept, I dreamed of the crows. I chased them. I caught them. I killed them. I did it for Eve. 29. For Eve, her death was the end of a painful battle. For Denny, it was the beginning. What I did in the park was selfish, because it was about me satisfying my basest needs. It was also selfish because it prevented Denny from going to Zoe right away. He was angry with me for having delayed him in the park. But to postpone, even for a short time, what he was to find at the home of the twins might have been the most merciful thing I could have done for him. When I awoke from my slumber, we were at Maxwell and Trisha's house. In the driveway was a windowless white van with a fleur-de-lis insignia on the driver's door. Denny parked in such a way as to not block the vehicle, and then he led me around the side of the house to the hose bib and back. He turned on the hose and rinsed the blood from my muzzle in a rough and joyless manner. It was not a bath. It was a scrubbing. "What did you get into out there?" he asked me. When I was cleaned of dirt and blood, he released me, and I shook myself dry. He went to the French doors on the patio and knocked. After a moment, Trish appeared. She opened the door and embraced Denny. She was crying. After a long time, during which Maxwell and Zoe also appeared, Denny ended the embrace and asked, "Where is she?" Trish pointed. "We told them to wait for you," she said. Denny stepped into the house, touching Zoe's head as he passed. After he disappeared, Trish looked at Maxwell. "Let him have a minute," she said. And they, with Zoe, stepped outside and closed the French door so that Denny could be alone with Eve for the last time, even though she was no longer living. In the emptiness that was all around me, I noticed an old tennis ball in the plantings. I picked it up and dropped it at Zoe's feet. I didn't know what I was doing, if I had a specific intention. Was I trying to lighten the mood? I don't know, but I felt I had to do something. So there the ball bounced to a stop at her bare feet. She looked down at the ball, but did nothing with it. Maxwell noticed what I had done, and he noticed Zoe's lack of reaction. He picked up the ball and, with a mighty heave, threw it so far into the woods behind the house that I lost sight of it and could only barely hear it crash through the leaves of bushes on its way back to earth. It was quite an impressive toss, the pale tennis ball sailing through the air against the clear blue sky. What amount of psychic pain was expended on that ball, I had no idea. "Fetch, boy," Maxwell said to me sardonically, and then he turned back to the house. I didn't fetch, but waited with them until Denny returned. When he did, he went to Zoe immediately, picked her up and held her tightly. She squeezed his neck. "I'm so sad," he said.
"Me too."
He sat on one of the teak deck chairs with Zoe on his knee. She buried her face in his shoulder and stayed like that.
"The people from Bonnie Watson will take her now," Trish said. "We'll bury her with our family. It's what she wanted."
"I know," he said, nodding.
"When?" "Before the end of the week."
"What can I do?" Trish looked at Maxwell.
"We'll take care of the arrangements,"
Maxwell said. But we did want to speak with you about something. Denny waited for Maxwell to continue, but he didn't.
You haven't eaten breakfast, Zoe, Trish said. Come with me and I'll fix you an egg.
Zoe didn't budge until Denny tapped her shoulder and nudged her off his lap. Go get some food with Grandma, he said. Zoe obediently followed Trish into the house. When she was gone, Denny leaned back with his eyes closed and sighed heavily, his face lifted to the sky. He stayed like that for a long time, minutes. He was a statue. While Denny was immobile, Maxwell shifted his weight from one foot to the other and back. Several times Maxwell began speaking, but stopped himself. He seemed somehow reluctant.
I knew it was coming, Denny said, finally, his eyes still closed. But still, I'm surprised.
Maxwell nodded to himself.
That's what concerns Trish and me, he said.
Denny opened his eyes and looked at Maxwell.
Concerns you?
He asked, taken aback.
That you haven't made preparations.
Preparations?
You have no plan.
Plan?
You keep repeating the last thing I've said, Maxwell observed after a pause.
Because I don't understand what you're talking about, Denny said.
That's what concerns us.
Denny, still sitting, leaned forward and screwed up his face at Maxwell.
What exactly are you concerned about, Maxwell? He asked.
Then Trish was there.
Zoe is eating an egg and toast and watching TV in the kitchen, she announced.
She looked at Maxwell expectantly.
We've just started, Maxwell said.
Oh, Trish said. I thought...
What have you said so far?
Why don't you take it from the top, Trish, Denny said.
Maxwell is having some difficulty with the opening. You're concerned? Trish glanced around, apparently disappointed that their concerns hadn't already been resolved.
Well, she began, Eve's passing is obviously a terrible tragedy. Still, we've been anticipating it for many months. Maxwell and I have discussed at great length our lives, the lives of all of us, in the aftermath of Eve's death. We discussed it with Eve as well, just so you know. And we believe that the best situation for all parties involved would be for us to have custody of Zoe, to raise her in a warm and stable family situation, to provide her with the kind of upbringing and, well, not to be gauche, but privileges we can provide for her. We think it will be best. We hope you understand that this is in no way a commentary on you as a person or your fathering abilities. It is simply what is in Zoe's best interest.
Denny looked from one of them to the other, a perplexed look still on his face, but he said nothing.
I was perplexed, too.
It was my understanding that Denny had allowed Eve to live with the twins so they could spend time with their dying daughter, and that he had allowed Zoe to live with the twins so she could spend time with her dying mother. As I understood it, once Eve died, Zoe would be with us. The idea of a transition period made some sense to me. Eve had died the previous night. To spend the following day or even a few days with her grandparents made sense. But custody?
What do you think?
Trish asked.
You can't have custody of Zoe, Denny said simply.
Maxwell sucked in his cheeks, crossed his arms, and tapped his fingers against his biceps, which were clad in a dark polyester knit.
I know this is hard for you, Trish said, but you have to agree that we have the advantages of parental experience, available free time, and fiscal abundance that will ensure Zoe's education through whatever level she might choose to pursue, and a large home in a safe neighborhood that has many young families and many children her age.
Denny thought for a moment.
You can't have custody of Zoe, he said.
I told you, Maxwell said to Trish.
If you could just sleep on it, Trish said to Denny, I'm sure you will see that what we're doing is right. It's best for all. You can pursue your racing career. Zoe can grow up in a loving and supportive environment. It's what Eve wanted.
How do you know that? Denny asked quickly. She told you?
She did.
But she didn't tell me.
I don't know why she wouldn't have, Trish said.
She didn't, Denny said firmly. Trish forced a smile.
Will you sleep on it? She asked. Will you think about what we've said? It will be much easier.
No, I will not sleep on it, Denny said, rising from the chair. You can't have custody of my daughter. Final answer.
The twins sighed simultaneously. Trish shook her head in dismay. Maxwell reached into his back pocket and removed a business envelope.
"We didn't want it to have to be this way," he said, and he handed the envelope to Denny.
"What's this?" Denny asked.
"Open it," Maxwell said.
Denny opened the envelope and removed several sheets of paper. He glanced at them briefly. "What does this mean?" he asked again.
"I don't know if you have a lawyer," Maxwell said. "But if you don't, you should get one. We're suing for custody of our granddaughter."
Denny flinched like he had been punched in the gut. He fell back into the deck chair, his hands still clinging to the documents.
"I finished my egg,"
Zoe announced. None of us had noticed her return, but there she was. She climbed onto Denny's lap.
"Are you hungry?"
she asked.
"Grandma can make you an egg, too."
"No," he said apologetically. "I'm not hungry."
She thought a moment.
"Are you still sad?"
she asked.
"Yes," he said after a pause. "I'm still very sad."
"Me too,"
she agreed, and she laid her head on his chest. Denny looked at the twins. Maxwell's long arm hung on Trish's narrow shoulders like some kind of heavy chain. And then I saw something change in Denny. I saw his face tighten with resolve.
"Zoe," he said, standing her up, "you run inside and pack your things, okay?"
"Where are we going?"
she asked.
"We're going home now."
Zoe smiled and started off, but Maxwell stepped forward.
"Zoe, stop right there," he said. "Daddy has some errands he has to run. You'll stay with us for now."
"How dare you," Denny said. "Who do you think you are?"
"I'm the one who's been raising her for the past 8 months," Maxwell said, his jaw set.
Zoe looked from her father to her grandfather. She didn't know what to do. No one knew what to do. It was a standoff. And then Trish stepped in.
"Run inside and put your dolls together," she said to Zoe, "while we talk a little more."
Zoe reluctantly withdrew.
"Let her stay with us, Denny," Trish pleaded. "We can work this out.
I know we can work it out. Let her stay with us while the lawyers come up with some kind of compromise. You were fine with her staying here before?"
"You begged me to let her stay here," Denny said to her.
"I'm sure we can work this out."
"No, Trish," he said. "I'm taking her home with me."
"And who's going to take care of her when you're at work?"
Maxwell snapped, shaking with anger.
"When you're off at your races for days at a time, who will take care of her if, God forbid, she were to get sick? Or would you just ignore it? Hide it from the doctors until she was on the verge of death, like you did with Eve?"
"I didn't hide Eve from the doctors, and yet she never saw anyone."
"She refused," Denny cried out. "She refused to see anyone. You could have forced her,"
Maxwell shouted.
"No one could force Eve to do anything Eve didn't want to do," Denny said. "I certainly couldn't."
Maxwell clenched his fists tightly. The tendons in his neck bulged.
"And that's why she's dead," he said.
"What?" Denny asked incredulously. "This is a joke. I'm not continuing this conversation."
He glared at Maxwell and started toward the house.
"I regret the day she met you," Maxwell muttered after him.
Denny stopped at the door and called inside.
"Zoe, let's go now. We can stop by later to get your dolls."
Zoe emerged, looking confused, holding an armful of stuffed animals.
"Can I take these?" she asked.
"Yes, honey, but let's go now. We'll come back later for the rest."
Denny ushered her toward the path that led around to the front of the house.
"You're going to regret this," Maxwell hissed at Denny as he passed. "You have no idea what you're getting yourself into."
"Let's go, Enzo,"
Denny said. We walked around to the driveway and got into our car. Maxwell followed us and watched Denny strap Zoe into her car seat. Denny started the engine.
"You're going to regret this," Maxwell said again. "Mark my words."
Denny pulled the driver's side door closed with a slam that shook the car.
"Do I have a lawyer?" he said to himself. "I work at the most prestigious BMW and Mercedes service center in Seattle. Who does he think he's dealing with? I have a good relationship with all the best lawyers in this town, and I have their home phone numbers."
We pulled out of the driveway with a spray of gravel at Maxwell's feet, and as we took off up the idyllic, twisty Mercer Island Road, I couldn't help but notice that the white van was gone, and with it, Eve. 30. With experience, a driver adjusts his understanding of how a car feels when it's near its limits. A driver becomes comfortable driving on the edge, so when his tires begin to lose adhesion, he can easily correct, pause, and recover. Knowing where and when he can push for a little extra becomes ingrained in his being. When the pressure is intense and the race is only half completed, a driver who is being chased relentlessly by a competitor realizes that he might be better off pushing from behind than pulling from the front. In that case, the smart move is to yield his lead to the trailing car and let the other driver pass. Relieved of his burden, our driver can tuck in behind and make the new leader drive his mirrors. Sometimes, however, it is important to hold one's position and not allow the pass. For strategic reasons, psychological reasons. Sometimes a driver simply has to prove that he is better than his competition. Racing is about discipline and intelligence, not about who has the heavier foot. The one who drives smart will always win in the end. 31. Zoe insisted on going to school the next day, and when Denny said he would pick her up at dismissal time, she complained that she wanted to play with her friends in the after-school program. Denny reluctantly agreed. "I'll pick you up a little earlier than I usually do," he said when we dropped her off. He must have been afraid that the twins would try to steal her away. From Zoe's school, we drove up Union to 15th Avenue and found a parking spot directly across from Victrola Coffee. Denny tied my leash to a bicycle stand and went inside. He returned a few minutes later with coffee and a scone. He untied me and told me to sit underneath an outdoor table, which I did. A quarter of an hour later, we were joined by someone else. A large but compact man composed of circles, round head, round torso, round thighs, round hands. There was no hair on the top of his head, but a lot on the sides. He was wearing very wide jeans and a large gray sweatshirt with a giant purple W on it.
"Good morning, Dennis," the man said. "Please accept my sincere condolences for your devastating loss."
He leaned down and forcefully embraced Denny, who sat awkwardly, hands in his lap, looking out to the street. Denny started, then stopped himself as the man released him and stood upright.
"Of course," Denny said uncomfortably.
The man nodded slightly, ignoring Denny's confused reply, and then wedged himself between the metal arms of the other sidewalk chair by our table. He was not fat, and in fact, he might have been considered muscular in some circles, yet he was very large.
"Good-looking dog," he said. "He has some terrier in him."
I lifted my head. "Me?"
"I don't know, exactly," Denny said. "Probably." "Good-looking animal," the man mused.
I was impressed that he noticed me at all.
"Oh, she pulls a good latte," the man said, slurping his coffee drink.
"Who?" Denny asked.
"My little barista in there, the one with the plump lips, the pierced eyebrow, and the dark chocolate eyes."
I didn't notice.
"You got a lot on your mind," the man said. "This consultation will cost you an oil change. My gull wing is very thirsty. An oil change, whether or not you decide to retain me."
"Fine.
Let me see the paperwork."
Denny handed him the envelope Maxwell had given him. The man took it and removed the papers. "They said Eve told them she wanted Zoe to be raised by them."
"I don't care about that," the man said.
"Sometimes she was on so many drugs she would have said anything," Denny said desperately. "She may have said it, but she couldn't have meant it."
"I don't care what anyone said or why they said it," the man said sharply. "Children are not chattel. They cannot be given away or traded in the marketplace. Everything that happens will be done in the best interest of the child."
"That's what they said," Denny said. "Zoe's best interest."
"They're educated," the man said. "Still, the mother's final wishes are irrelevant. How long were you married?"
6 years.
"Any other children?"
"No."
"Any secrets?"
"None." The man drank his latte and leafed through the papers. He was a curious man, full of twitches and extra movements. It took me several minutes to realize that when he touched his hand to his hip pocket, which he did frequently, it was because he had some kind of buzzing device hidden away, and by touching it, he could stop its buzzing. This man's attention was in many places at once. And yet, when he locked eyes with Denny, I could sense the totality of his focus. Denny could too, I knew, because in those moments, Denny's tension slackened perceptibly.
"Are you in a drug treatment program?" the man asked.
"No."
"Are you a registered sex offender?"
"No."
"Have you ever been convicted of a felony, spent any time in jail?"
"No."
The man stuffed the papers back in the envelope. "This is nothing," he said. "Where is your daughter now?"
"She wanted to go to school. Should I have kept her at home?"
"No, that's good. You're being responsive to her needs. That's important. Listen, this is not something you should be overly concerned with. I'll demand a summary judgment. I can't see why we won't get it. The child will be yours, free and clear.